All right, if you want to grab your Bibles, we are in Daniel chapter 8 this morning and making our way through this book. We've got about four classes left and five chapters, and so we're going to cover chapter 8 this morning, chapter 9 next week, and then we're going to divide up the last three chapters into two classes. It's one vision that he has in those last three chapters. We are in the section of the book of Daniel where Daniel is receiving a number of visions from the Lord. The first six chapters are the chapters of the book that we know very well. Those are the stories in the life of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that we know very well. But you get to these last six chapters, and these are visions that Daniel had received. They are prophecies that God is giving to Daniel about future events. And as you go through these chapters, there's a lot of what's called apocalyptic language. That similar kind of language that we find in the book of Revelation that's written in signs and symbols. And sometimes that's difficult for us to understand and to see what we are supposed to take from that. And so we're trying to make our way through these each of these prophecies and give a little insight as to what Daniel was seeing and the interpretations that were being given to him in these various visions, and to see just how incredible these visions were that the Lord was giving to him. What we're going to see this morning in Daniel chapter 8 is a prophecy that's given to Daniel 400 years before it ever takes place. And if I don't mention it later as we get into this chapter, we'll mention it a few times before the end of the class in January, but we mentioned this in the introduction, and that is of the book back last month, and that is that there are a lot of critics to the book of Daniel that want to say that the book of Daniel was written somewhere around the 1st or 2nd century B.C., that it was written at a time where it was just recording history, just recording events that happened as they were happening or after they happened, like any historian would record history. When you went to your history class in school, they weren't recording history before it happened. They're recording history after it had happened. Well, that's what some critics want to make Daniel to be. He's just recording things after they happened. And the reason they do that, especially with the book of Daniel, is how precise he is in what he records about these events. And so they say he could not have written this in the 6th century B.C., because there's no way he could have known 400 years before they happened just how precise of things that were going to happen. Well, Daniel could not have known those. That's absolutely right. But did God know with precision things that were going to happen 400 years before they happened? And absolutely. And so a lot of critics want to take Daniel out of the time of Daniel when he was in Babylon and bring it out to some other later time, just because they don't believe in predictive prophecy and they want to take that element away from the Bible. But that's one of the strongest elements to prove that the Bible is from God, are these predictive prophecies. So in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel is seeing from the Lord a vision about a ram and a goat. And so that's the focus of our class today, is Daniel's vision of a ram and a goat. And this is 2 years after the vision we saw last week. Chapter 7, it was the first year of Belshazzar in verse 1. And chapter 8 in verse 1, now we're in the third year of Belshazzar. Remember, Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And so this is after Nebuchadnezzar has died. This particular chapter is two years after chapter 7, but it's 12 years before chapter 5. Remember chapter 5, Belshazzar sees the handwriting on the wall. Daniel sees this vision 12 years before Belshazzar saw the handwriting on the wall, and that was the last night of the Babylonian rule. And so we see just some background information here in the first couple verses that Daniel sees a vision, but he's sort of taken away from where he is in verse 2, and he's at least in the vision that he's being shown, he is in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and he saw a vision that was by the river Ulai. And these aren't things that make any sense to us, because geographically we are challenged when it comes to some of these ancient areas. But this would be an area that was about 200 miles east of Babylon, about 150 miles north of 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf. So get Iran, maybe if you got geography today, get Iran in your mind, and that's sort of where he is. And he's by the river Ulai, which he's going to bring up again in just a little while. But here's what I want to do. I want to throw this outline up here, and I'm going to fill in the middle here as we go through this. But here's what Daniel sees. And I want you to think about seeing this kind of a vision. And what did Daniel think it meant as he went through it? Well, when we get down to verses 20 and 21 and 22 and following, it's told to him what this meant. And they get in the interpretation is very specific. Verse 3, "Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river where he was a ram, which had two horns." Remember, we are in apocalyptic language. Remember, we are in this symbolic kind of signs that God is showing to Daniel. Remember chapter 7, where he saw these beasts coming out of the sea. And each beast, what did each beast represent? There were four beasts that came out. What did those each one represent? Four different kingdoms. And that's what Daniel was told in chapter 7, is that these four beasts represent four kings, four kingdoms. Well, you get to chapter 8, and he sees a ram by a river. Well, do you suppose this ram is going to represent something? That's the whole nature of this kind of literature and this kind of language. He sees a ram. A ram was typically a symbol of princely power, and this ram had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one of the horns was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Well, what in the world is this all about? Go back to chapter 7. Remember chapter 7 in verse 5, where Daniel saw the second beast come out of the sea, and it was a bear, and it was raised up on one side. So he saw this bear come out, but he's raised up on one side. What did we learn from Daniel chapter 7 that second beast represented? What empire? The Medo-Persian Empire. That Medo-Persian Empire was made up of the Medes and the Persians. The Medes were powerful at one time, but the Persians came along and defeated them and dominated them, and that's the side of the bear that was raised up higher than the other. Well, what's Daniel seeing in verse 3 of chapter 8? He's seeing a ram that's got two horns. One horn is higher than the other, and it came up last. He's seeing the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, think about this. He's seeing this during the days of the Babylonian kingdom. Belshazzar is a Babylonian king. You might say, well, how do we know that the ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire? Well, in your Bible, you might write next to verse 3, write verse 20. What? The interpretation that he's given in verse 20 is very specific. The ram which you saw having the two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. We're not left to wonder what this means. We know exactly what he's seeing. He's seeing a vision about a kingdom that's going to come after Babylon. Babylon doesn't fall for another 12 years. What Daniel is seeing are things that no human could have seen. Babylon doesn't fall for another 12 years, but he is seeing another kingdom arise. Now notice what he says, or what he sees in verse 4. "I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward." If you go and study the expansion of the Persian Empire, you will see it expanding in all of these directions so that no animal could withstand him. So you notice it goes westward, northward, southward. Did it ever go eastward? Was there ever a queen, was there ever a Jewish queen who had a Persian king as a husband? Esther. If you read the first verse of the book of Esther, it talks about the Persian Empire going from Ethiopia all the way to India. The very first verse. So there you see it even going eastward later on. So what Daniel is seeing an empire that is expanding in all of the directions. Nor was there anyone, verse 4, that could ever deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So here's this great Medo-Persian empire that has great success in conquest and doing whatever it pleases. Now, did the Medo-Persian Empire last forever? Well, of course not. Verse 5, "As I was considering, suddenly a male goat, or your Bible might just say a he-goat. That's how the Old King James and American Standard and other translations had it. A male goat, a he-goat, came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between its eyes. Now what's he seeing? Well, obviously this is a different kind of animal. Go back to chapter 7. What do we see in chapter 7, verse 6? After this, after the Medo-Persian Empire, verse 6, I looked, and chapter 7, verse 6 says, I saw an animal like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. If a bird had four wings, could it fly faster than a bird with two wings? That's the whole point, is the speed by which this animal is moving with these four wings. How fast was this animal moving? Come back to chapter 8 and verse 5. This animal was moving so fast that it looked like he wasn't even touching the ground. Well, what's Daniel seeing? Right next to that verse, verse 21. The male goat is what? Kingdom of Greece. God specifies this for us. So I want you to think about the book of Daniel. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar sees an image that had four parts to that image. And Daniel comes along and says, what do those four parts represent? They represent four different kingdoms. What did we learn about those four kingdoms in Daniel chapter 2? That Nebuchadnezzar saw the Babylonian kingdom, then he saw the Medo-Persian kingdom, then he saw the Greeks, and then he saw the Roman kingdom. And in verse 44 of Daniel chapter 2, it says, in the days of these kings, in the days of the Roman kings, God is going to set up His kingdom. His kingdom's not going to be like these other kingdoms because it will never be destroyed. It's going to stand forever. And then we come to Daniel chapter 7, and Daniel sees a vision with four beasts. What do those four beasts represent? The same four kingdoms. Then we come to chapter 8, and now he's seeing another vision. But this time, it's about just two beasts. One of them is this ram, which was the Medo-Persian Empire. But then he saw this male goat that comes out. And this, verse 21 tells us, represents the Greeks. What is the end of verse 5? The goat had a notable horn between its eyes. Well, what does verse 21 tell us about that notable horn? The large horn between its eyes is the first king. Who does Daniel see? Who is the large horn? It's Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great do I have all of this up here? Yep. Alexander the Great was obviously the first king of the Grecian Empire, was the most successful of those kings. And so that's what Daniel sees in this horn at the end of verse 5. Verse 6 says, he came to the ram. Who came to the ram? The male goat. The male goat came to the ram. What's the ram? Medo-Persian Empire. The ram with two horns. And which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. What's happening? What is Daniel seeing? He's seeing war. He's seeing a war between the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greeks. The Greeks come along. They had been oppressed by the Persians for a period of time, and now they come and they overpower them. Verse 7 says, in the middle of it, there was no power in the ram to withstand him, the male goat, the Greeks. And he cast him down to the ground, trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So we see a transition of power from the Medo-Persian Empire over to the Greeks. Verse 8 says, therefore the male goat, who's the male goat? Grecian Empire. The male goat. What? Who's the large horn? We're going to read you about the large horn here. Alexander the Great. The male goat grew very great. Here's the goat had magnified himself exceedingly, not just in power and not just in expanse, but in arrogance as well. But when he became strong, the New King James says, when he became strong. Other translations say, at the height of his power, the long horn was broken. Who's the long horn? Alexander the Great. Did Alexander the Great, according to this passage, did he live out his life to a ripe old age and enjoy a lot of peace and tranquility. No, he's at the height of his power. He died. Alexander the Great was 33 years old when he died. You know that he had conquered the known world, made it all the way to India, wept because in his mind there were no more lands to conquer. And so he dies, but he does not have an heir in order to take over the control. And so the large horn was broken. That's the death. The large horn was broken, talking about him dying. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Go back to chapter 7 again. I want you to see the connection between these texts. Go back to chapter 7 and verse 6. The leopard that came out of the sea, on its back was four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. We talked about what those four heads might represent back in chapter 7. Well, come over back to chapter 8. In verse 8 says, in its place were four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Well, what are those four notable ones? Go to verse 22. God tells us in verse 22, as for the broken horn, that's Alexander the Great, and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So four horns represent four kingdoms that came forth or from the Grecian Empire. What's this talking about? It's not talking about Rome yet. Remember the four kingdoms in chapter 2 and in chapter 7, that after the Grecian Empire was the Roman Empire. Well, the Grecian Empire is not done yet. They're just divided. Alexander the Great ruled over the entire empire, but when he dies, he doesn't have a single heir, doesn't have an heir to give his kingdom to. And so his kingdom is divided among his four generals. And his four generals take the various parts of his kingdom. And so the Grecian Empire continues, but continues under different men in these different places. Let me share with you those four generals. We're going to talk more about this when we get into chapter 10 a little bit. But it's divided into four areas under these four generals. The first general is not, these first two are not really names that we're familiar with. If you go and study history, you'll read about these first two. But it's the last two that we're more familiar with. It's the last two. When we get into chapters 10 and 11 and 12 in a couple weeks, it's these last two that come into play. And the reason that they're more prominent in the Bible is because the last two are the ones that have something to do with God's people. These first two on the list really didn't impact God's people so much because they're in further places out of Palestine. But within that area of Palestine and close to it, one of those rulers, one of his generals, was Seleucus, and Seleucus took this region of Syria and Mesopotamia. Well, if you look on your Bible map, Syria is right there in Palestine and is the northern part of Palestine. And then you've got his general Ptolemy, and Ptolemy had Egypt and Palestine. Now, think about your geography, and in your mind, you've got the Mediterranean Sea over here on the right let me put the Mediterranean Sea on your side. So the Mediterranean Sea is over here. You've got Palestine here, and then you've got desert over here. So here's Palestine between the Mediterranean Sea and desert. This is a fertile area. This is a much trafficked area. This is a great area to control if you are an army, if you're a nation, if you could control that middle between the sea and the desert, if you can control that, you've got a lot of power. Well, that's where Palestine is. That's where God's people are. And so you got Syria and you've got Egypt, and here's God's people right in the middle. And so when we get to chapters 10, 11, and 12, it's going to talk about the north and it's going to talk about the south. The north is Syria. The south is Egypt, and God's people are right there in the middle. And so as this power of Greece is divided among these four generals, Going to that, verse 8 says, going toward the four winds of heaven. Verse 9 says, and here's this is key in this chapter and when we get to the end of the book. Verse 9 says, out of one of them, out of one of the four horns, came a little horn. Now, last week we read about a little horn in chapter 7. This is not the same little horn. Just because we're reading the same words, little horn, as we did in chapter 7, doesn't mean it's the same little horn. Well, why not? Because we're reading about the Grecian Empire in chapter 8, whereas we were reading about the Roman Empire in chapter 7. The little horn in chapter 7 was an emperor in the Roman Empire. Here we're talking about Grecian Empire, and so that's where this little horn fits in. Just remember that this is figurative language, not to identify one person as a little horn, but just to say, here's a king. And that's what a horn would represent, would be a king. And out of one of them, a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Who is this little horn? This little horn we're going to read about in this chapter, and we're going to read about him especially when we get into chapter 11 in a couple weeks. This little horn was one of the kings who persecuted God's people more than anybody else. Not in the Roman Empire. Don't fast forward to the Roman Empire. We're talking about the Grecian Empire, divided up into four different areas, and this particular king was one of the worst. And as we read through this, we will be able to identify him, but let me go ahead and put his name up here so that you can become familiar with it, because we're going to talk a lot about him in these last few weeks of the class. His name was Antiochus, and he was divided into four different areas, four different kings, rulers. Seleucus was one of them who took Syria. And so one of the kings that followed Seleucus, actually the eighth in line, or the eighth king after Seleucus, was Antiochus IV. When we get into chapter 10, we're going to read about some of his predecessors in the Syrian kingdom, but we're also going to read about Antiochus IV. He called himself Epiphanes. What does that mean? Epiphanes means an illustrious one. He called himself Theos Epiphanes. He was the manifest, illustrious Theos God. That's what he called himself. He called himself, referred to himself as a god. And so he becomes the king of the Syrian nation. Again, this is a part of Greece as a whole. Verse 9 says, this little horn grew exceedingly great toward the south, going down towards Egypt, going towards the east, into the land of Persia, and toward the glorious land. What would the glorious land be? That's Palestine. That's God's people. We're going to read that same expression when we get into chapter 11. And it grew, verse 10, up to the host of heaven, and cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground, and trampled them. Again, figurative language. Don't get in your mind that this is some fairy tale that he went up and he grabbed the physical, literal stars and cast them down. This is a figurative way to talk about him going up and casting down and trampling upon God's people. Remember what God said to Abraham about his descendants? They would be like the stars of the heaven. Well, that's the figurative language here, is that he is trampling upon God's people. And he's so arrogant, verse 11. He's so exalted. He magnified himself so much that he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. Well, if verse 10, the host is talking about God's people, and in verse 11, the host is talking about God's people, who is the prince of the host? Well, let me help you out. The Bible will tell us. Drop down to verse 25. The end of verse 25 says, he, talking about Antiochus IV Epiphanes, he shall even rise against the prince of princes. Well, who's that? Would the prince of princes be the same person as the king of kings? Would the prince of princes be the same person as the lord of lords? Same person. So if he's going up against the Lord of Lords. If he's going up against God in verse 25, verse 11 is interesting. It doesn't say that he's going up against God. It says that he is making himself as God. He has elevated himself to be God in the eyes of the people. And so that's what he, again, that's what he told the people to call him was Epiphanes. His given name was Antiochus. That's what his mama called him. But now he is calling himself Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. I am the manifest God, and that's what you are to call me. But behind his back, the people didn't call him Epiphanes. Behind his back, the people called him Epimanes, which meant madman, because he was. He was a little crazy. But so he exalts himself as the prince, verse 11, as the prince of the host. But notice what happens. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. This is one way that we know that this is talking about Antiochus, because of what transpires here. Antiochus, as the screen says, Antiochus ruled from 175 to 164 B.C. During this time, again, he's the king of Syria in the north. But as the text says in verse 9, he comes down and he conquers the south in Egypt. He is dominating that whole area of basically the Grecian Empire. But he's taking over Palestine. And when he comes through Jerusalem, he wants to take out their religion. He wants to take out those people, and he does. But he wants to take out their religion. And so he puts a stop to the daily sacrifices. Remember, the Jews offered offered a sacrifice in the morning, offered a sacrifice in the evening, and he puts a stop to that. This is about the year, we know when it is. It's in December of 168 B.C. December of 168 B.C., he comes through Jerusalem, and he puts an end to their daily sacrifices. The end of verse 11 says, the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Antiochus went into the temple, and on top of the altar of burnt offering, he erected, think about this, in God's temple, there's the altar of burnt offering. He erects a pagan altar inside there, and he offers a sacrifice to Zeus inside God's temple. Rutrow is right. And so that's Antiochus. That's what he's doing to God's temple. That's what he's doing to God's people. Now, why would God let that happen? What's the first part of verse 11 tell you? The New King James says the first part of verse 11, because of transgression. Why is all of this happening to God's people? Why are they being destroyed? Why are they being dominated by this king? Why are their sacrifices being stopped? Because of their sin. Because of their transgression, God is, and they're basically they're turning to adultery, not adultery, idolatry, the other allery. They were turning to idolatry, and because of that, God was allowing judgment to come upon them, and so the host was given over along with the daily sacrifices. He cast down truth to the ground. He did all of this and prospered. If you were a Jew in Palestine and you were found to be in possession of a copy of the law, you were put to death. How would you like to be a Jew in Palestine when Antiochus is the king? He put an end to the law, to their rule. He put an end, tried to put an end to their truth. He tore up every copy of the law he could find. He tore it up and he threw it in the fire. But if you were found with a copy yourself, you were put to death. How would you like to be one of God's children living in that day? When it says he cast down the truth to the ground, he did. And he did all of this and he prospered in doing it. Verse 13, then I heard, Daniel's talking, then I heard a holy one speaking. He hears a heavenly being, an angel of some kind. He heard him speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking. So he sees two heavenly beings talking, and one of them says, how long will the vision be? Wouldn't you want to know that? You see this happening to God's people. You see this vision of a king coming in and dominating. He ends the daily sacrifices. He's sacrificing to Zeus in the temple of God. And so wouldn't you want to know, how long is this going to last? How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host, that's God's people, to be trampled underfoot? How long is this going to last? Verse 14, one of the harder verses in the book of Daniel. Verse 14, he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Or your Bible might say, that the sanctuary would be properly restored or restored to its rightful place. So how long is this going to last? God, how long? And that's an interesting, oftentimes when God's people were under persecution, that was the question. How long are you going to let this happen? Remember in Revelation chapter 6, when the fifth seal is opened and John saw under the altar, those who had, the martyrs who had been beheaded for the cause of Christ, and what were they crying out? How long? Oh, Lord, holy and true, how long are you going to let this happen? That's the question here. How long is this persecution going to last? The answer that's given is 2,300 days. Remember, we are in apocalyptic language. We are reading figurative language. Are we to take that as 2,300 literal days? I don't think we're to take that as 2,300 literal days any more than we're to take the ram or the goat as a literal ram or a literal goat. Those were figurative. And so anytime you're reading Numbers, not the book of Numbers, the fourth book of the Bible, but anytime you're reading Numbers in apocalyptic language, here or in the book of Revelation and other places, oftentimes even those numbers are figurative. And so I don't know that we are to take that as a literal 2,300 days. And so when you get to 2299, you know, okay, it's just one more and we're done. It could be figurative. It could just be saying, here is an indefinite time, but it's a limited time. Some have tried to figure out, could there be some sense of measurement to these? I mean, how long is 2,300 days? I mean, that's a lot of years, isn't it? And so could it be that roughly 7 years of days, could it be talking about a time frame of 7 years of persecution? Or if you've got a, maybe your Bible says, or maybe you've got a footnote on the word days, what is the word days literally? If you've got a footnote here, 2,300 literally evenings and mornings. If you flip over to verse 26, verse 26 says the vision of the evenings and the mornings, that's literally what the days are. So when he says in verse 26, the vision of the evenings and mornings, that's the 2,300 days of verse 14. And so, could he be talking about 1,150 24-hour periods, but 1,150 evenings and 1,150 mornings, so 2,300 evenings and mornings? Individuals have tried to figure out how can this be understood. Who's being discussed here? The king that's being discussed here is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who did all of this, who was a vicious king, persecuting God's people. And so in about the year, or not about, we know it was the year 167 BC, there was a man by the name of Mattathias Maccabees. You may have read 1st and 2nd Maccabees, interesting books. There's a section of books that are called apocryphal books. If you've ever done studies and various books that people think should be in the Bible, There's a section of book called the Apocryphal Books. They are not inspired. They are not written by God. And so understand that. But in that apocryphal section of books that some people read and study are books called 1st and 2nd Maccabees. The Maccabees family was a family that stood up against Antiochus and said, "We're not going to deal with your persecution any longer. We're not going to allow you to tell us as Jews what we can and cannot do as Jews." And so Mattathias Maccabeus in 167 BC and his five sons went to battle against Antiochus to fight for their freedom. Fast forward a couple years, December 25th, 165 B.C. Don't say Christmas, but think Christmas, okay? December 25th, 165 B.C. is the day we know in history because of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Those are good historical books. Not inspired by God, but just historical books. December 25th, 165 B.C. is when the temple was cleansed and when they went in and they rededicated the temple. Think about it. Get rid of this altar to Zeus. Get rid of all of these pagan altars. Cleanse all of that. Let's go back into God's temple. They resurrected the altar to God. They offered a sacrifice to God, December 25th, 165 B.C., and burnt incense to God on that day. And it was a time of rededication. It was a dedication of the temple. They lit the lights on the menorah, December 25th, 165 B.C. But they called it a dedication. Interestingly, in John chapter 10, verse 22 of John chapter 10, you've got a record in the New Testament of the Feast of Dedication. Well, if you start looking up Feast of Dedication in the Old Testament in your concordance, you're not going to read about it. It's not the Feast of Passover. It's not the Feast of Pentecost. It's the Feast of Dedication the Jews made up in 165 B.C. If you took the Hebrew word for dedication, and you took that Hebrew word and you transliterated it, meaning you just take the Hebrew letters and you transliterate that Hebrew letters and bring it down into an English word, like people did with baptize. Baptize is just a transliteration of the Greek word baptizo. If you take the Hebrew word for dedication and transliterate it into an English word, you know what English word we come up with? Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the English transliteration of the Hebrew word dedication. Where does the Feast of Hanukkah come from? Right here. Feast of Hanukkah came from the dedication, the rededication of the temple in 165 B.C. when finally the Maccabeus family had conquered and done away with Antiochus and was able to go in and to dedicate the temple again. That happened 2,300 literal or perhaps more figurative days after Antiochus was persecuting his people. Now, very quickly, I've only got 5 minutes. I've got another half of a chapter. 2,300 days. Some people have said, could that be literal? If you take December 25th, 165 B.C., and you rewind 2,300 days, you get into the year 171 B.C., which is when, interestingly enough, which is when that Antiochus began his assault against the Jews. Some people have said, no, well, maybe it's not 2,300 days, maybe it's 2,300 evenings and mornings, so it's 1,150 days. Well, if you back up that period of time, you get into 168 B.C., and what happened in 168 B.C.? That's when Antiochus came into the temple and set up his altar to Zeus and offered a sacrifice there. I don't think we're looking at literal days here, maybe a general time frame of but it's to note limited time, it's to note an end to this time, and to see that God is in control. Very quickly, we've got 5 minutes and a lot of important information to cover. Verse 15, then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning. Suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. He sees an angel. And I heard a man's voice between the banks. Think about that. Between the banks. He's hovering over the water. We'll see that again in chapter 12. Who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So this voice from hovering over the water says to Gabriel, make this man understand. This is the first time we read Gabriel in the Bible. We will read him one other time in the book of Daniel, and we only read about him twice in the book of Luke at the announcement of the birth of John the Baptist and the birth of Jesus. Here is one of God's messengers. And so Gabriel, in verse 17, he came near where I stood, and when I was afraid and fell on my face, he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision, please put this in context, verse 17, understand that the vision refers to the time of the end. I know that when we read that expression, the time of the end, our minds go to the end of the world, because that's the time of the end that we think of. And there's a lot of other people who have come to this. Oh, this is talking about the end of the world. This is not talking about the end of the world. Put that expression in this context. What was the question that was asked in verse 13? How long is this going to last? Put that in the context. Daniel is being given an answer to how long is this going to last. So he's being told when the end of Antiochus's persecution is going to last. So please put that in the context. It's not talking about the end of the world. Daniel's talking about when is this persecution going to end? When is the temple desecration? When is it going to end? Verse 18. As he was speaking, I was in a deep sleep. On my face, verse 19, he said, "Look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the wrath, of the indignation, the end of this persecution. For at the appointed time, the end shall be." What end? The end of Antiochus's persecution. We see the interpretation, verses 20, 21, and 22, of the ram and the goat and the large horn and the four kingdoms. Verse 23 begins talking about Antiochus. Verse 23 through verse 25 is about the little horn. It doesn't say little horn here, but that's who it's talking about from verses 9 through 12. So you might write out in your Bible next to verse 23, this is Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. He is the ruler of the Seleucid line, one of those four kingdoms. Verse 23, about this little horn. In the latter time of their kingdom, latter time of whose kingdom? The Seleucids. When the transgressors, the Jews, because of their sins, when the transgressors have reached their fullness. What does that mean? When the fullness of the measure of their sins, when their sin has run its course and God's going to punish them for their sins, a king shall arise. Who's that? Antiochus. Antiochus shall arise having fierce features. He's an insolent, vicious, dangerous man who understands sinister schemes. He is a deceitful, crafty man who, in order to defeat the Jews, he just turned them against each other. We don't have time. I wish we had time to go over to chapter 11, and we'll see some of his sinister schemes over in chapter 11 when we get there. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty. But where did he get his power? His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He's a powerful guy, but where did he get his power? From God. What did we learn in chapter 4? God rules over the affairs of men. He gives it to whomever he wishes. God gave him this power. Well, why would God do that? To punish his people for their sins. He shall destroy fearfully, shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, the Jews, the host. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. He shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against God himself, the Prince of Princes. Do you have the word but in verse 25? He is so arrogant, he's going to go up against God. But he shall be broken. That's the end that Daniel was looking for when he was broken. Remember when it talked about Alexander the Great, it used the word broken to talk about his death. That's what's being talked about here with Antiochus. He shall be broken, but not in battle. He shall be broken without, the New King James says, without human means, without human agency, but not by any human power. What does that mean? God took care of him. In God's time, God took care of this man. And we don't have time to talk about his death, but it's an interesting story to read about this man's death. Verse 26, the vision that Daniel saw of the 2300 evenings and mornings was true. So the angel told him, Gabriel told him, seal it up. For it refers to many days in the future. Daniel saw this vision 400 years before it happened. Are there some details in here about kingdoms? Are they being named? Who would have known that the Medo-Persian Empire was going to come 12 years later? Who would have known that the Greeks would come along 200 years later and defeat the Medo-Persians? Who would have known that 400 years later, there would be a king from the Seleucid line who would come into the temple and sack it and set up his own altar there? Who would have known that 400 years before? God. That's why some people want Daniel to have been written after all of these events happened, because of the precision of the prophecies that are here. That ought to give you, that ought to build your faith to know that Daniel was writing these things 400 years before they ever happened. And it took it out. Look in verse 27 very quickly. It took it out of him. He fainted. He was sick. To think about God's people being persecuted and suffering just was more than he could take. And then he went up about the king's business. But he was astonished because Gabriel did not answer all of his questions. He did not understand everything about this vision. We understand more about it than Daniel did, because we are seeing this on the back end, and we see all of these things come to reality just the way that God said that they would. I hate that our time is up, but we are 2 minutes past. Thank you all very much for your good attention this morning.